Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast. Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Welcome to episode 126 of the podcast, everybody. Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel with you here.
Again, hungover Andrew Frankel.
You want to get that out there right away, do you?
Yes. If I'm slightly on less than my usual scintillating form, it's because it's quite worrying. This is it's Monday as we're recording this, and my daughter had a much delayed 21st on Saturday night here. And I think I'm kind of thinking it's kind of lack of sleep as much as anything else. But if I sound a bit croaky, that's why.
That'll be why. Oh, good. Well, I'm glad to hear that. I remember when I turned 30 and I realised that I was starting to get 2-day hangovers.
Yeah.
They would literally last 2 days.
Yeah. Try 56.
Well, I'll let you know.
I'll be happy if I'm back on good form by this time next week.
Okay. Well, I'll try and do most of the talking then. And we've got another busy episode. And we're going to start with some news about the intercooler, hopefully exciting news. And it's that we have a brand new podcast series coming this week. On Thursday, Last Blast arrives, and we're very excited about it. Do you want to sort of explain the concept behind Last Blast?
Yeah, I think you and I, when we first started doing this podcast, you came to me and you said, let's do a podcast. And I said, fine, who are the guests going to be? And you went, no, we're not going to have any guests because we haven't got the time. It's just going to be you and me. And I said, well, that's a really stupid idea because who's going to want to listen to you and I blathering on relentlessly? But apparently a few do, which is fantastic. And we never forget it and we're always grateful for it. But we have always wanted to do a series with these strange things called guests on it. Which is what we're going to do. And we thought that rather than just sort of sit them down and chat, which would be nice, and we have absolutely done that, but we thought we'd give them a bit of a structure, get them to do a bit of homework, make them think about it. And so what we have done is come up with this format called Last Blast, and the entire point of the podcast is that right at the very end of it, after discussing the various cars that have been important to that person's life, whether it's because they've owned them or driven them or raced them or built them or just literally had them pinned on their bedroom walls when they were kids, what would they take their last ever blast in? What would they have their final drive in? We also make them say where that drive would be. We also make them tell us who they would be with. We also make them tell us what their first car was, their first crash, what the first time they ever drove on a racetrack, all that sort of stuff. Each one is about an hour long, some are a bit longer. I've recorded most of them. They're all, I think the phrase is, in the can. And it's been tremendous fun to do. We've got some wonderful, wonderful guests who I'm so proud have agreed to come on and talk to us about these things. some really surprising stuff in there, some quite touching stuff in there. I'm just so excited about getting it out there. A bit nervous, but hopefully you all enjoy it. And yeah, let us know what you think.
Yeah, so it's all about the quality of the guests, isn't it? And I'm not going to spill the beans. We've got a series of six Last Blast episodes on the way, starting from Thursday, and released weekly after that point. I'm not going to tell you who all the guests are, but we can talk about the first one.
Yeah.
And on Thursday, our Last Blast episode with Sir Chris Hoy lands. And it's a really good interview because he's an interesting guy. He's the sort of guy you want to hear from because of all his success, everything he's achieved. He also just loves cars, loves racing.
I was so starstruck. It was really embarrassing. because actually, you know, I can go and talk to, and we do actually, one of the Last Blast coming up is with, you know, a big important boss of a big important car company. And I can do that without thinking about it. But put me in front of a six times Olympic gold medalist. He's our second most successful Olympian and an 11 times world champion. And it's all just a bit daunting. I hope it doesn't come across too much. But in fact, and I know everybody says this about every guest, but he is such a nice bloke. He is so easy to talk to and he's so passionate about his cars and his choices and his life. I sort of went in there thinking, oh, blimey, and came out again thinking, that was a joy. That was such good fun. Mm. So hopefully some of that will come across.
Yeah, no, it does. It really does. And, you know, he takes cars seriously. He takes racing seriously. He raced at Le Mans, and he talks about that a lot in the episode. It's really good.
Yeah.
Last Blast is sponsored by Footman James, the insurance company. So thank you to Footman James for making Last Blast possible in the first place. Footmanjames.co.uk if you're on the lookout for car insurance. The final thing to say about Last Blast, it's an important thing to say about Last Blast, it's for TI subscribers only. It sits behind the paywall on our website and app. And if you want to listen to the episodes in full, an hour plus each one, you do need to be a subscriber to the Intercooler. So if you're already subscribed, well, thank you. And also, hopefully this is a nice additional treat for you, starting this week on Thursday. If you're not yet subscribed already and you've been meaning to, maybe now is the time to do it with Last Blast on the way.
We're going to be really cruel. So we are going to release a chunk of it, aren't we, onto all normal podcasts. But we'll make sure the chunk doesn't tell you what the Last Blast is going to be. It won't even tell you what most of the cars are going to be. But you will be able to hear enough to get a feel for how it all works, and hopefully enough to entice you to come and subscribe to it. And I think the point about that is, you know, although obviously we don't pay guests to come on it, they come on it because they want to and for no other reason. It does take time and it does take money to organise this stuff, to do it, to edit it, to put it together, to put it out. We're incredibly grateful to Footman James for helping us with that. But we genuinely think, and I try really hard not to be big-headed on this podcast, but we think it is, well, we're proud of it. We think it's quite a special thing. And, you know, like all special things, I don't think it's unreasonable to hope that people would put, what are we talking about? You know, well, the way the beer is going at the moment, I always used to say that a subscription to TI cost a pint of beer a month. It's going to be about a half at the moment, the way the price of beer is going. But anyway, for that kind of money, to be able to access everything that's on the website, all the incredible writers that we have there, and this, you know, brand new podcast series, I hope that people don't think that's an unreasonable thing to ask.
Mm. Yeah, well, I agree. Okay, so there we go. That gets going on Thursday this week. Look out for it. We will, yeah, as you say, we will release a chunk of it to general podcast audience. So you'll find an excerpt on your podcast feeds on Thursday. But if you want the whole thing, you're going to have to get on to the Intercooler. And you can do that at the-intercooler.com. And actually, you can start a free trial, can't you, and listen to the first few episodes. Okay. All right, let's move it on a little bit and just talk about some of the stuff that we've posted on the Intercooler app and on the Intercooler website in the last few days. I think I want to highlight one in particular, and it's called The Bravest Man I Knew, which is
What a story.
It's a brilliant story, but also a really unique insight into actually a unique character. It's all about Donald Campbell.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a sort of a bit of a land speed record fetishist. I've been in love with it and obsessed with it since my earliest days. But the problem is, you get to a point where you've kind of read it all. You know who did what, when they did it, when it went wrong, when it didn't, and the stories are all very similar. But this one isn't. This isn't the sort of, you know, purple prose. Gosh, wasn't he a brave bloke? Wasn't he? I mean, this is so. Gavin Green, former editor of Car Magazine, has written this for us, and he wrote it because when Donald Campbell broke the land speed record in Australia in 1964, his father, Evan Green, was the team manager, and nobody that I have read has been able to provide a greater insight into this very complex man. So although it's called The Bravest Man I Ever Knew, which is a direct quote from Evan Green, it's not all praise, is it? It's a really, really interesting insight into the stresses that he was feeling, the pressures, the backstory, the kind of person that he was. It made me look at an event I thought I knew all about in a completely different way. It's a really, really cracking read. Gavin is a superb writer. You know, anybody who's read his stuff in, well, everywhere from, you know, Car Magazine to British Airways High Life magazine will know what a good writer he is, and he's done a superb job for us.
Yeah. Okay, a couple of other pieces I want to just flag up. We've had Karun writing about life as a Formula One pundit and commentator. He was out there over the weekend, wasn't he, at Zandvoort, working for Sky Sports F1, and he reveals some proper insight into what it's like to be a F1 pundit, having been an F1 driver. And actually, he's a good person to do it, because I've always said he's Sky Sports' most insightful analyst. I always learn more from him than I do from, you know, even some of the much more, I guess, illustrious or experienced F1 drivers that they have on their pundit list. It's a very revealing piece. We've also had Joe Fidalgo, writing about motorcycles, because she took part in the Mahle Mile, which is a motorcycle festival like no other. Actually, I'd never heard of this event before, but it does sound like a lot of fun.
You get very muddy, don't you? Well, you get covered muddy, this time of year, you get covered in dust and rubbish.
Very dusty. Yeah, it's the sort of piece I want to read. I'm not sure it's the sort of thing I want to do. And just this morning, we've published a piece that you've written, and it's recalling the time a decade or so ago that you took Stirling Moss and Norman Jewis back to the Mille Miglia.
I did it because it's 10 years and I still can't believe that they're both gone, and I sort of think of it and I think just how fun and full of life and on it they were. Talking hangovers, the one I had on the, whatever it would have been, the Saturday morning after that, when, you know, Sterling, Norman, myself and a few of the other people who are making this film, which I talk about in the piece, retired to the bar. And I just kind of thought, because we'd been on the go all bloody day, and these guys were seriously old. Even then, I mean, they were both, no, Norman was in his 90s and Sterling was in his 80s. And I thought it would just be a sort of quick drink, but bite a bit, and not a bit of it. I think I ended at 1 o'clock in the morning with Norman trying to tempt me to have another gin and tonic. And I just said, no, I just can't do it. So we took them back to Brescia because at the time it was the 60th anniversary of them doing the Mille Miglia in a C-Type, where they proved the concept of the disc brake, and we were making a film about them proving the concept of the disc brake. So we took them back there. They were, even then, the last surviving original Mille Miglia crew. We had an extraordinary experience there. They got absolutely mobbed. It's sad that they're not with us, but the film we made is out there, and there's a link in the piece, I think, and it's on YouTube, so go and see it.
Yeah, do that. Okay, Dutch GP. We're not going to talk about it much because
I didn't see it. I was too hungover. No, I wasn't too hungover. I was clearing up, and I was taking another daughter back to university. And no, I haven't seen it, but I've read about it.
Okay. All right. Well, we won't linger too long. We all know that Max won, George second, Charles third, and all the talk really is about whether or not Mercedes could have done something differently to have won the race. And actually, when you talk to people really in the know, I did message Karun about this, and I said, if Mercedes had actually left both cars out during that, for that final stint, could they possibly have held Max behind? And he just said no. It seems to me that no matter what they did after that that full safety car, Max was going to be too fast. He was just going to come through on fresh tyres with a quicker car and win the race.
But there is some conspiracy theory stuff going on around there. I mean, Toto is saying that, because it was the AlphaTauri, wasn't it? with the wheel come loose, or hadn't it come loose? And Toto was quite clearly insinuating that he thought there might have been some funny stuff going on with the Red Bull sister team. I mean, I haven't seen it, but I mean, the point is that, you know, we're already at a stage now where, for Max to not be world champion this year would require the biggest upset in the history of Formula One. You know, he is so far, he is so far past the point where, you know, he doesn't need to race the Ferraris anymore. It just simply doesn't matter. He can let them go. They could be 20 seconds a lap quicker. They can come first and second in every race at the end of the, from now until the end of the season. He's still world champion. It simply doesn't matter. So are they really going to do that? I mean, maybe they would say, oh, yes, but it was his home Grand Prix. It was the one he wanted to win. Yada, yada, yada.
I don't get it. I think it's naughty of Toto or anybody else to suggest there's some funny business there. You know, and I would have loved to have seen the Mercedes win.
Me too.
I think even before that first, Tsunoda's virtual safety car, the virtual safety car he caused, it was looking like it was going to be the Mercedes on harder tyres having one stopped at the end of the race, Max having two stopped with quicker tyres, and he'd only have been a few seconds behind them. Even then,
and with
he
the
would
straight
have come
line speed
through.
That Red Bull has, it's so stupidly fast, and with that enormous straight.
He would have come flying through whatever. I don't think the Mercedes were ever going to win that.
Even Mercedes' own analysis actually says that there's no way that they could have won it. I really want George to win a race. And, you know, I think he is doing, given, and I know that Lewis has had some genuine bad luck, both in this race and the one before. But I think he is doing a stellar job, given who's in the other car on the other side of the pit garage and how that team has been built entirely around Lewis. And George is keeping him honest, isn't he? I mean, it's nip and tuck here and there between them. And I just think he's an absolutely outstanding driver. If you can keep up with Lewis Hamilton, at times more than keep up with Lewis Hamilton, I think you are, well, you're as good as Lewis Hamilton, aren't you?
He is going very well. I think Lewis has got him covered in qualifying at the moment. And I think if all things are even, I think Lewis does have him covered in the race as well, but it hasn't been panning out that way. And fair play to George. I mean, he's been doing what he needs to do to beat Lewis his result. So fair enough.
How many races are we in now? We are something like 15 races into the season?
Something like that.
Yeah, and I know that Lewis has had some bad luck, and there's not a huge points difference between them, but, you know, it does all even out over time, and George is still leading Lewis by, you know, a bit. So I'm not saying for a moment that he's better than Lewis, and Lewis has absolutely had more bad luck than George, and I suspect that had that not happened, it might be the other way around. But just to even be in the same ballpark as Lewis Hamilton, that's the thing. You look at Bottas, who frankly didn't see which way Lewis went for most of the times that they were driving together. In an Alfa Romeo, Bottas is actually doing quite a good job. So I think, you know, Bottas is clearly, you know, a pretty decent driver. But compared to George, he's nowhere relative to Lewis.
The point is with Bottas and George, Mercedes were succession planning, weren't they, for when Lewis disappears? Because Bottas was never going to lead that team. They needed another superstar driver in that team, which is why they brought George in, who appears to be of the Lewis Hamilton mould, it would seem. But what I think we learn more next year when Mercedes actually have a functioning car, hopefully. You know, presumably they're going to learn a lot from this year's... well, it's not been great, has it? But I want to see Lewis versus George in a car that's genuinely working for both drivers, that they can do what they want to do in, that has a chance of winning races and championships, maybe. And I think
they're almost there. I mean, we've already said this about Mercedes, isn't there? That, you know, nobody develops a car like Mercedes through a season, and they always come strong at the back end. Okay, they still haven't won a race this year, but, you know, compared to where they were, you know, they are now, you know, they are now talking very bullishly about beating Ferrari to P2 in the constructors.
Yeah, and
at the start of the season, that was a joke. That was unimaginable. And okay, Ferrari have, you know, not exactly covered themselves in glory in terms of strategy and everything. Am I right in saying that they only brought three tyres out for Sainz's first pit stop?
Well, there you go. And that's what we're going to talk about for the next few minutes. So Sainz came in, and I think it's a very late call from him or from the team to pit. And so the team weren't ready for him. He had three tyres ready to go, which isn't a great deal of use in F1, is it?
He lost.
I think he lost 10 seconds or something, and it just totally knackered his race. And it's another example. Well, also, quite apart from that, Charles came third, you know, making the most of what happened to Lewis towards the end. But they weren't at the races. They weren't challenging for the race win. No one was really talking about them. It was all Red Bull and Mercedes. And so Ferrari just weren't there. And then they had another cock-up with Sainz in the pit lane. And it's just yet another example of that team not functioning at the level, anything like the level that it needs to.
And Binotto has to ultimately hold his hand up to all of this.
Yeah.
I mean, ultimately, you know, someone needs to do the maths. I suspect that, you know, even if they'd made no mistakes at all, I think the gulf is so big, I suspect that Max would still be world champion. But, I mean, if they lose P2 in the constructors to what appeared to be at the start of the season a completely no-hope team, you've got to question Binotto's position at the top of that team, don't you?
I mean, he seems like a really nice guy,
but, you know, you come into that season after everything that Ferrari's been through, and it appears that you have the quickest car. And you've got, if not the greatest, then probably the second greatest driver lineup on the grid, and you throw it away.
And it's actually, the Ferrari v Mercedes thing is an extraordinary thought, because back at the start of the season, Leclerc was winning races, setting pole positions, and the Mercedes were nowhere. So it's a hell of a turnaround, isn't it? We wanted to talk about other F1 cock-ups, certainly to do with the pit lane, because there have been some good examples over the years. Can I give you mine?
Go on.
And this was catastrophic. This was China, 2007, McLaren, leaving Lewis Hamilton out for too long in the rain on knackered tyres. Lewis's rookie season, this was the penultimate race. They left him out too long. He cooked those tyres. They called him in, slippery, wet pit lane, off his slides, painfully slowly, into a gravel trap, beached, out of the race.
Lost in the championship.
There's no question that that lost in the championship. He'd only needed to have finished 5th, 6th, 7th in that race to have had a... He would have won the title in Brazil the following time out. It was a catastrophic mistake. And the point about that was, this was Lewis's rookie year. That cost him his title, the title in his rookie season. How extraordinary would that have been? First year in F1.
It's never been done, has it? Apart from Nino Farina in 1950.
Which doesn't count,
because it
clearly
was everyone's rookie season in Formula 1. Yeah, it doesn't really count.
That is a catastrophic gaffe, isn't it, that one?
But let's spool forward a year to Singapore, 2008. Massa.
Ooh, crikey. Yeah.
Was released with the fuel hose still attached.
Oof. Yeah.
That cost him a championship too. Remember how close that championship was?
Where was he running, do you know, in that race? Presumably at the sharp end, because he tended to be that season.
I think he was leading it. I don't know, but it certainly cost him a stack of points, and he lost it by one.
One, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, maybe that's equally as big, isn't it?
I mean, you know, we've been very critical of what Ferrari have done. Okay, so we don't refuel it anymore. But I mean, in terms of pit lane cock-ups, that's right up there, isn't there?
Yeah, that really is.
Yeah,
Championship losing pit lane cock-ups. How many have there been? It doesn't happen often.
No. Okay, can I do a funny one? Sorry, he's not going to. He's not. China 2012. Stopped at the wrong pit box.
Oh yeah. Where did he go? Which one?
He went to Red. He decided to pop in and visit his chums at Red Bull.
Yeah. Oh dear. That's happened a couple of times, isn't it? I think when Lewis had just switched to Mercedes, he went via the McLaren pit box. Force of habit, I suppose.
Force of habit. Yes, you're right. It did, didn't it? Can we do an early one?
Yeah.
And actually, I think in the end, it was kind of good that this happened. Fangio, German Grand Prix, 1957. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
The race was kind of in the bag for him, and he came in and he had the pit stop from hell. I can't remember whether they couldn't get a tyre off or they couldn't get a tyre on, but one of the two. And a pit stop, which should have taken, even back then, a very small number of seconds, ended up like taking a couple of minutes. And he was so far behind, everybody went, oh, okay, race over. Because by this stage, Mike Hawthorn and Peter Collins were just miles ahead in the lead. And the only person who thought that wasn't going to happen was Fangio. And he broke the lap record on every single consecutive lap after that till the end of the race. And he won the race. And what he was helped by was it's such a long lap. In the pits, they could see what was happening. But it took such a long time for them to realise just how bad the situation was. And then for them to be able to communicate that news to their drivers. By the time they got the hurry up, Fangio was on them.
That's a good point. Yeah, because a normal circuit, you'd have, 30 opportunities to flag, to let the Ferrari drivers know what's going on, that they're in trouble.
Well, but here, Monaco was 100 laps, but the German Grand Prix was 14.
Mm. Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they found out that they had a big problem on their hands far too late. So that was kind of a good one. So what others have we got?
What you got?
Okay, what have I got? I do write them down. Unfortunately, my handwriting is so bad at them and I can't even remember it. Well, I mean, can we talk about the 2005 US Grand Prix? I mean, this wasn't really a sort of pit lane cock-up, although it was tyre-related.
Yeah.
Michelin suddenly discovered that their tyres couldn't go through turn 13.
Mm. What a fast
and
that
so,
was.
Yeah, and so they said that all their drivers would have to slow down. And the problem with it was, if you remember, there were no pit stops. Because normally what you do is you just say, well, sorry, guys, if your tyres only last 13 laps, you've got to come in and change them after 13 laps. But that wasn't allowed in the regs. And Michelin's idea was...
Was it one set of tyres for the race at that point?
Yeah, absolutely. You had to go the whole three on the same set of tyres.
Bloody
hell. And so Michelin's idea was that they'd install a chicane just before the banking, at which stage the Bridgestone runners, who were only Ferrari, Jordan and Minardi, just said, well, hang on a second. This is your problem. This is not our problem. We don't want a chicane there. So why should we have to put up with a chicane being there? Because you can't make tyres that can go around a bank corner. And so they thought, well, yeah, fair enough. And so they all went out for the race, didn't they? And at the end of the warm-up lap, all but six of the cars went back down the pit lane.
Yeah.
And
that
was that. And it was the most... I mean, it took years for the US Grand Prix to come back after
that.
Oh,
that's the thing. Yeah, the thing. The damage it did to F1 in North America. What do you think the correct decision there would have been, given the damage that was done to F1? What should F1 have done?
Put the chicane in, had a race, done whatever was necessary. You've got to think of the greater good. Make it up in some way to the Bridgestone runners in some other way. But to have a race, which wasn't a race, to have six cars on a grid, frankly, only two of which had the smallest chance of winning, both of which belonged to the same team. It was an absolute utter farce, and they should have taken a more strategic view of it and copped the flak from Bridgestone and the Bridgestone runners and just, frankly, done a deal and put the chicane in.
Yeah.
But not easy, really.
Because only now is F1 taking off in North America again. It took 15 years for that to heal, didn't it?
Yeah.
There we go.
Biggest ever pit lane blunder?
What, it's not one of the ones we've mentioned already? I think
the Jos Verstappen fire in Germany in 94.
Yes. That's pretty.
You were... Sorry?
That was pretty catastrophic, that one.
Well, except it wasn't. I don't think anybody... I think Joss burnt the end of his nose because he put his visor up for the pit stop. Yeah. He just wanted to get a bit of air and he got a bit of flame instead. But
well,
nobody
well,
was
this is
and,
it.
I remember
it was,
seeing it and it just looked horrendous.
But it was just a little bit of fuel that spilled over the car and ignited, and that was always going to burn off very quickly, wasn't it?
I know. But even so, when you see it for the first time...
It looks like an explosion, actually. And that's why we imagine it was much worse than it actually was, because it does look like something's blown, but actually it was just a splash of fuel igniting, and then it was out very quickly, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. Well, I hope at least we've made Ferrari's strategists realise that these things have been going on for decades, and it's nothing new to cock up a pit stop.
It's been going on since there have been pit stops, haven't there?
And it always will, won't it? I guess it's because there's so little time to think and there's such pressure. And so many moving parts as well. Do you think, how many people are involved in a pit stop now? Strategists, team boss, lots of mechanics, driver, engineer. Mm. There's a lot of people. And if you're not operating absolutely as one unit, it's going to go wrong at times, isn't it? And that's what Ferrari are demonstrating.
Can I tell you about my worst pit stop?
Go on.
Okay, so this was the Spa 6 hours about 4 or 5 years ago. It was late. I was doing the night shift in the trusty old Ford Falcon. And I was somewhere out around the back of the circuit. I felt a vibration. And I thought, might be a bit of pickup, but it didn't go away. And so as I came down the... because we used the old pits for the Spa 6 hours. As we came down... As I came down towards Eau Rouge, I was still going reasonably fast, but the whole car was doing this a bit. I was flashing the lights to tell the guys on the wall that I was coming in. And so I sort of wobbled around the next lap, came into the pit, nobody there at all. They got so bored, they sort of disappeared back into the pit garage, and there wasn't anybody there. So I just sort of sat there like a lemon, thinking, where the hell is it? I think they were all having a cup of tea out the back. They had no idea I was coming. I sort of came in, and so I thought, well, I better go back out there again. And I think it was something like a wheel weight had come off, and so we changed the tyres, and it was fine. But to come down the pit lane and find nobody waiting for me was a little bit chastening. They apparently weren't quite so awestruck by my prowess and my lines through Eau Rouge that I kept them sort of spellbound from start to finish. They were out the back having a cup of tea. Thanks, guys.
Well, there we go. I don't think even Ferrari have managed that one yet, have they?
No one, though. There is. No, usually, you know, at least Sainz had 3 out of his 4 tyres. I had nothing at all.
Well, 3's not much better, I have to say. All right, good. Yeah, I mean, motor racing cock-ups are going to keep happening, aren't they?
They are.
All right. One other thing I wanted to talk about this week. How to replace an Alpine A110. I've been on the hunt for a new car.
Oh, how are you getting on? Have you found something?
I have.
Oh my!
I have.
Well, can I guess?
You can, but not yet. I'm going to string this out a little bit.
Go on.
So my Alpine went to its new owner a couple of weeks ago. I've been on the hunt for a new car ever since. And actually, it's a long old while since I've been, you know, pouring through classified ads on Auto Trader and Piston Heads and all the rest of it, trying to figure out what car I want, because when I bought the Alpine, I knew exactly what I wanted. I wanted an Alpine. I didn't consider anything else. And so it's been years and years since I've ummed and ahed and vacillated and swung back and forth. And what's been curious this time around is that I found myself genuinely considering an enormous range of cars and an enormous range of budgets, different types of funding. So I've looked at spending a couple of grand cash on some disposable car that would maybe keep me going for a year or two. I've looked at leasing a brand new, just a little city car, just something so that I had wheels, do that for a couple of years. I've looked at different finance options, PCP, a bank loan. I've looked at brand new, I've looked at used. Just about everything that's sort of within my reach financially, I've quite seriously considered it. I've also thought about some fairly reckless stuff. I think I mentioned last week a Jaguar XJR.
Yeah,
I mentioned
that's quite reckless.
A Panamera. a Panamera V8 as well. Definitely. Okay, it's not totally out there, but it's reckless by my standards, I think. And I would love to smoke around in a XJR or a V8 Panamera for a bit. And actually, they would suit me. I'd really enjoy knocking about in one of those until the bills started coming in. And to be honest, I just don't think that's a sensible game to play with borrowed money. Maybe I'm being overly cautious, but it just doesn't seem like it's a grown-up thing to do, to borrow a load of money and then stick it into a car that could end up costing you a huge amount to run, particularly when things are going the way they are with cost of living and whatnot. I've also considered, and I would really love to have a BMW i3. I really fancy a little electric car.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing I'd actually rather drive around town.
Yeah.
Sadly, the i3, it just doesn't work for me, because most of my driving, particularly given where I live, you know, where do we work? We work out towards London or up in the Midlands where all the car makers are. We work in Wales where we photograph cars. We go to airports a lot, don't we? So a lot of my driving is up and down the motorway. and for that, the i3 just doesn't quite work for me. I'd also want the i3S, the more powerful one with the bigger battery, which is the more recent version. They're actually still too expensive. So from Panamera V8 to BMW i3, you can see sort of how torn I was, how unsure I was about what kind of car I needed. And so I did in the end decide to play it a little bit safe. And I thought, I was convinced that the solution here was a Ford Fiesta ST, 2, 3, 4 years old. And I went to drive a couple. I love those cars. I think I spoke about this in a recent episode. I just think they're brilliant fun to drive. I went to drive a couple last week. I was ready to drive home in one of them. I thought one of these cars will be absolutely right and I'll bring it home with me. I just don't know if a 40,000 mile Fiesta ST is quite the car that I remember so fondly. It might also be that, so both of these cars were at one of those car supermarkets. Both of them on a total, mismatched tyres. On a couple of corners, it would have a good high performance tyre that you'd heard of. It might have a Michelin Pilot Sport, Super Sport. On the others, it would have some budget thing that you've never heard of at all.
Yeah.
And all that stuff, it just means that these cars do not drive quite the way that I remembered them.
It also means they've not been looked after. They've not been, owned by people who are bothered about that sort of thing. And maybe it doesn't matter on a 2, 3-year-old car, I don't know. But that would set warning bells off in my head.
Well, what really set warning bells off in my head was, one of them was a black car. And it had 17-inch wheels, which was the standard wheel option. Almost all of them were specified with the bigger 18s, which do look better. And I actually quite fancied the 17s. I thought, oh, these might improve the ride. Might feel a bit sweeter on these smaller wheels. Actually, I drove it back to back with the car on the 18s. And it might be that this particular car wasn't in good nick. But the one on the 18s felt so much better. I think it had done fewer miles. It had been looked after a bit better. This black car with the 17s. I drove it and there were a couple of issues with it. It was making a weird clonking sound and I was, a bit unsure, a bit unconvinced. And then I leafed through the service manual. Nothing. Not a single service. 3 years old.
Oh,
40,000 miles. Not serviced once. Not serviced once. And I said to the dealer, to the salesman, I'm not going to buy a car that hasn't been serviced once. And he goes, nope, nor would I. And it was really interesting. I suppose, cars that haven't been looked after, if they've been part X, they find their way into these car supermarkets and they find their way to auction, don't they? Just trying to offload.
So how many miles did this car done?
It was high 30s, I think, maybe 40,000 miles.
So it's done what? It's done almost 2 laps of the planet on the same oil.
Yeah.
Forget that. I mean,
that engine is not going to be in good nick. Yeah. So I did. I disappeared. Mm. Yeah. So it was, and the other one wasn't quite right. It was a bit more than I wanted to spend. Didn't have some of the options that I wanted. So, yeah, that had to go. It wasn't, Yeah, so the car with the 18s and the lower mileage wasn't a performance pack car, and the performance pack has the diff, and I wanted the diff. So I do find myself quite tempted sometimes when I'm there with a car that would just about do the job, and it's not quite right. And sometimes I think, oh, it'd be all right, wouldn't it? And I have to stop myself and think, no, don't rush this. Take your time. Get the car that you really want. I also found myself, and you do this, don't you, on Auto Trader or whatever, just sort of looking at different options. Range Rover Sports, KNs.
Have you seen the price of fuel recently?
Well, there you go. That's probably why I didn't do it. But also E46 M3.
Yeah.
Because the thing about those cars is that they're just not going to lose any value now, are they?
No.
And that is the biggest cost of motoring.
Yeah.
You know, so it doesn't matter
if it costs a bit more. You'd have to get a really good one, though, wouldn't you?
That's it. You have to get a really good one. Otherwise, it's not going to be the car you imagine.
You'd have to spend time on the forums. You'd have to see. Well, actually, Jo Fidalgo's got one, hasn't she? And I'm sure she knows what to watch out for and that sort of thing. But if you did get a good one, which would be worth spending a bit of money on it, I mean, okay, you spend more money on it, but compared to the depreciation you're not going to incur. See, I think that's what I'd probably do, but you clearly didn't.
I didn't. No, I've decided to play it a little bit safer. I think I just want something that I know isn't going to cost a huge amount to run. Something that I know I'm going to enjoy driving. That's important. Something that is going to suit my lifestyle for the next couple of years. We have a baby coming. So I think realistically, I do need to be able to cart a baby around in it.
Vauxhall Grandland.
Sorry?
Vauxhall Grandland.
No. I think I'd be booted off this podcast if I did that. So, something that I want you to guess what it is. Moderately practical. Something that's still going to be good fun to drive. Something that's going to be dependable.
Yeah.
What do you reckon?
Well, I mean, bloody hell. I mean, you know, M140i.
Decent guess. Decent guess. I looked at a couple, certainly online, but I had one. I've had one before, an M135i. And so I don't really want to go back. But yeah, pretty much.
Golf GTI.
Bingo.
Bingo! Yes!
Bingo.
Oh, wow. Well, okay.
Second guess. So it's a Mark 7.5.
Oh, bloody hell.
It's a performance. So again,
it's got five doors. You have remembered you've got a child coming, haven't you?
It's got five doors. It's lovely and low mileage. I think it's a 2017 car, so it's an early Mark 7.5, but it's done 20 something thousand miles, so it's not been around the block. It's a performance, so it's got the bigger brakes, the extra power, and it's got the diff. This one, importantly, has dynamic chassis control, the adaptive dampers. Which was one of the things actually that swung it for me, because it's very hard to find one of these cars with that option. I was surprised.
So you haven't told us the most important thing about this car.
Go on.
How many pedals?
It's got a manual gearbox.
Yay!
So it's a manual Golf GTI Performance 7.5, Mark 7.5, with the diff, with the extra power, with the bigger brakes. Dynamic chassis. It's perfect. The spec for me is absolutely spot on.
Do you know what? Can I say something about Golf 7 point? They are people will remember the Golf 7 as being the absolute apex of Volkswagen engineering excellence. You know, after that, you know, you had Dieselgate came in 2015. They've all run out of money. And obviously huge investments had to go over into creating EVs, which just means, and we're seeing it now, that, you know, the Golf 8 is just nothing like the car, the Golf 7. And we have, funnily enough, a Golf 7.5 here, which isn't a good GTR or anything. It's our family runabout. It's a 1.5 something or other. But it was the cheapest one we could get with the fully independent rear end. And it's every time I get into it, I just think to myself, what a great car. It's so well engineered. I think that's an absolute... I was kind of hoping you'd have chosen something I could take the piss out of, but actually it's a cracking choice. It's an absolutely terrific choice.
Do you know what? I have played it a little bit safe, but I'm still really excited.
Were you tempted by an R at all? Or is it just too expensive?
Well, They're a little bit more expensive. I looked at a couple online, but I had one when I was at Evo. I had a long termer for a year, so I've done that. You know, I've ticked that box, and I fancy the GTI this time around. It's Fair also enough. A VW approved used car, so it's got a warranty on it for a couple of years, which helps.
What colour?
So it's grey. So I've gone from one grey car to another, which I really didn't mean to do. But when you find the right spec,
doesn't matter.
For me, colour just doesn't matter.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's a really, really good shout.
So I'm going to, annoyingly, it's in Southend-on-Sea, which is not near Bristol.
No.
So I'm hopping on the train tomorrow. As long as I like it and it's the car that I think it is, I'll be coming home in it. So there we go. I'm excited.
Well
Golf
done.
GTI.
Well done.
I think people aren't going to be as excited as I am because it's a fairly middle-of-the-road choice, I suppose. But I don't know. I don't care. I'm excited. And I'll let you know what it's like next week.
Please do.
But it just made me realise that when we're buying cars, and particularly if you really love cars, it isn't necessarily the case that we figure out what type of vehicle we want and then consider the different makes and models in that class. That's certainly not how I've bought this one. I've looked at so many different options and I've been seduced by something over here and then something totally different over here. It's like an exploration rather than a simple journey for me to be. And it's actually been frustrating, but really good fun.
And this is, you know, I think one of the mistakes, well, we make plenty of them all the time, but one of the mistakes that car journalists make all the time is they think in straight lines. They think, well, they think in classes and they think people. I can remember having a conversation with someone. I met them at a party. I can't remember who they were, but they had about $100,000 that they wanted to spend on a toy. And they couldn't work out whether to get a Range Rover Autobiography or a Ferrari 458.
Oh, yeah, there you go. It illustrates it really nicely, doesn't it?
It's just bizarre.
Yeah. It's not as straightforward as we like to imagine it is sometimes.
No.
Good, okay. All right, well, we've got a listener question coming up. Again, you haven't heard it before. But before we do that, thank you to everybody who has reviewed and rated the podcast. I see your reviews coming in and they're very kind. So thank you. But please keep doing it because that's how we find a new audience. Please also go and check out the-intercooler.com. It's our beautiful new website. We're very proud of it. We publish what we think are brilliant stories every single day by what we think is the best writing team in the world. So go to the-intercooler.com and start your free trial. So the listener question name.
Well, just before you do that, also, and I don't want to sort of, you know, bang on about it, but on Thursday, when we release the chunk of the new Last Blast podcast, have a listen. And if you're somebody who's been kind of, because Dan and I keep on banging on about it, thinking about maybe subscribing to the website and to the app, have a listen. And if that is enough to, you know, do the trick, then fantastic. We'll see you. We'll see you on there as well, and then you can listen to the whole thing, and you can find out what Chris Hoy would take his last ever drive in, with who, and where it would be.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, well said. Okay, Adam Griffin. Then, what is the genre of vehicle that no car manufacturer has produced that you think would do well in the market? So, a type of car that has never existed before that would do well. And he says, for instance, nobody has ever built a really, really big estate car. So we've had A6 size, 5 series sized estate cars, but not one above that. Not A8, not 7 series. Imagine the load bay, he says. Needn't be any longer than a regular A8 or 7, but would offer a level of practicality no other car could, he says.
But if you're going to do that, you know, you just, I mean, I've been running around in a Volkswagen Multivan. Okay? It's fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, there is so much space. And if you're going to do that, you know, that's the way you go, isn't it? You just get a really big MPV. And there are plenty of big MPVs. So that kind of covers. That's an almost impossible question. Because, you know, the problem is that if you'd asked me this question 20 years ago, I could have answered it very easily because there were so many gaps between all the classes. But they've all been filled in now because you get these cars which are, you know, estate, SUV, coupe, hatchback, sports, you know, nonsense. And, you know, all the car classes are kind of collapsed on top of each other. I'm going to have to give that a moment's thought. If you feel like filling in with a few thoughts of your own here at this stage, that'd be great, because you've seen the question and I haven't.
I'll do it. And I don't think it's a good idea now, but I do remember thinking when I lived in the middle of town and I had a small, awkward parking space, and for a brief while I was running a Mercedes S-Class, which was a lovely thing to knock about in. For a long drive, it was pretty peerless. But where I lived, in the middle of town with a small parking space, a car that long, that big, was a pain. It was really annoying. And I wondered if you could fit all of that luxury, not the space, I know, but that luxury, that ride comfort, that refinement, into a much smaller car, C-class size. And I know there's an issue with wheelbase and ride quality, but I would have been down for a car like that at that point. But I suppose when they want a luxury car, they want space. When they're spending a lot of money, they want physical presence and size, don't they?
Okay.
But very luxurious small car is the point.
Well, okay, so I would, it's fine. So you have prompted me. So you were talking about something the size of the C-Class. I've had this thought, but in a much more extreme way, a really luxurious city car.
Yeah.
Okay? And now a really luxurious electric city car. Mm. The only people who have tried it were Aston Martin with the Signet, and it didn't go well. the car was, but that's because it was a completely half-hearted attempt, because everybody knew it was a Toyota IQ with some posh leather bits and a silly grill. I think the execution was wrong there. I don't think the concept was, because I do know a few people who live in cities. They're not massive fans of of the public transport system, getting on buses, that sort of thing. They do want a city car, and they all drive smarts and ups and that sort of thing. But so many have said to me they would just like, because they spend so much time in them, they would just like that to be a premium experience. And I think that if somebody did do a really properly executed little city car, but the problem is, how much money could you charge for it? And I think what you'd find yourself is, in the worst of all worlds, we know, don't we, that car manufacturers make money two ways out of cars, either by selling millions of them or by taking massive margins out of them. And I think that would be the worst of both worlds. I don't think you'd sell a huge number, and you couldn't take an awful lot of money out of them. So, that's a nice idea. And I think a truly luxurious, really small city car, something that is smart-sized, but with all the gear, all the equipment, really nice music machine in it, and proper nav, a real home from home, would be lovely. But I just don't think the business case would be there to support it.
Mm. There you go. Well, good. All right. Well, get your listener questions across because they're good fun. We'll do another one next week when Andrew might not be hungover.
Possibly. Don't count on it.
Thanks all.
All right. Cheers.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.